set, Mr. Jack Murdoch, chairman of the board and one of the founders of Tektronix Corporation. Tektronix, I think, is fondly thought of by those of us who have the privilege of living in the Northwest as one of our own. It certainly stands preeminently in the field of its product, in the field of the oscilloscope, and I think the story of Tektronix must include a story of one of deep understanding of human relationships within a corporate business enterprise. Jack Murdoch.
Well, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for that very nice introduction. I have my doubts, though, after hearing the last speaker. The standards you set are pretty high. I don't know whether I'll be able to tell a story as well as he will or not, as he would or not. However, I do have copious notes here, and I hope that I don't get too tangled up in getting the basic message across. I'll be speaking to you really as a very, very lay person today on a subject that I consider extremely interesting, challenging, but complicated. About 23 centuries ago, a gentleman named Aristotle made the prediction that when the shuttle weaves by itself and the lyre plays by itself and loaves of bread come forth from the oven completely untouched by human hands, human slavery will end. Well, today's technology would make us think that this prediction has arrived several years ago. However, the fact that you are all here and I'm here today to speak, I believe, primarily on the effect of automation on individuals and society might indicate that the simple removal of work from human activity is not the complete answer to our long-time dream. Since man is composed of both mind and body, he needs two kinds of tools, as I see it, to get his work done. One for mental expansion and one to do his physical or mechanical work. I suppose a pair of pliers would illustrate the simplest kind of mechanical extension of the hand that enables you to do many things you couldn't do otherwise. Things like boats, automobiles, airplanes, and so forth are extensions of the physical body's mobility that it could not accomplish by itself. But the machine age hasn't really helped too much in the solution of man's very basic desire for real satisfaction from work. Some people wonder if man should work at all, because we can now imagine that machines can do both the mental and the physical work of our society. This has been put forth by various people for various times. I know you've all heard this. However, I, for one, doubt very much that machines will completely replace human beings for a couple of reasons. First, with regard to the so-called surplus of human talent, I wonder how many in this room have tried to get a few simple things done around the house, like housework or yard work, or even try to get some of our modern mechanical or electronic gadgets in the house repaired. If you can get it done at all, it's only with much frustration and delay, if at all. So there's still a lot of things to be done. It seems that job opportunities, the standard of living, creative challenges for human beings all increase with mechanization. simply because we are never satisfied. My second doubt about machines replacing us is based on the basic nature of man himself. And I'm getting into an area now probably over my head after your last speaker. He knows much more about this than me. But as a layperson, some of you know, I've served on the board of the Menninger Foundation in Topeka, Kansas for the last 8 or 9 years. I hear a few of the pros talk about some of these things from time to time. At Menninger's, much research has taken place, as it has across the country, regarding the nature of man, his personality, what helps him develop into constructive, effective activities, and what things keep him from doing constructive things. First, humans seem to be a gregarious animal simply by observation. If you look at the importance of the family unit, the many group activities we all participate in, and the fact that most of us don't do very well if we are completely isolated for very long. So if you get down to some of the basic things, there are four general areas that Menningers have talked about several times, and the first and most important one here today is work. And I'm using the word work to denote any kind of constructive human activity for which someone else is willing to pay. Work still appears to be one of the best avenues for human beings to build ego strength, relate meaningful to others, and to derive real satisfaction from work or from their personal efforts. Perhaps we should mention a few other Menninger observations while I'm on this subject, because I think they tie into automation. Another area that healthy people participate in is play. As you can see today, many more people are indulging in recreational activities, particularly the participative types, over the spectator type sports, simply because it's easier to do and it's more accessible. Another area that's very basic to our good health is the pursuit of knowledge, which not only requires increased time but increased availability of information. Looking ahead a few years, it seems quite possible to me to imagine that computer library centers might become available to most all of us simply through the telephone. Then, besides work, play, and the pursuit of knowledge, the fourth area of human need is to create. And this has been referred to already, and you'll probably hear more about it before the day is over from other people. While there are infinite opportunities for creativity expression in the fields of music, art, improved design of housing, transportation, all kinds of tools and equipment, probably the greatest opportunity of all is in the field of figuring out how we humans can survive a little bit more constructively. And Dr. Hirschberg laid the groundwork for that very nicely. Just to mention a few of our other more serious social problems, we are still plagued with war, crime, juvenile delinquency, divorces, and many others, which indicates that at present, with our abundance of knowledge, we're not solving the problems very effectively. But maybe with the advent of cybernetics and automation, maybe we can begin to take more of a systems approach to some of these social problems. Separately, but no less important, to what I've just mentioned is our national safety problem. The other day I was in San Francisco and heard the president of the National Safety Foundation quote some figures like, during 1965, there were 107,000 Americans killed in all types of accidents, and about 10 million more were injured. And they estimate the total cost of these accidents in one year to be about $18 billion, which is more than one-sixth of the national budget in 1965. Certainly, this is going to take a very sophisticated and creative attack to solve social problems of this magnitude. It's in the area of creativity, I think, where automation might well be a godsend to the human race. When Professor Hertzberg started out, I thought maybe he was going to say all the human problems are solved and there's really not much left to do. But as he went on, I see there it really is quite a complex problem. And from my experience with technology and human problems, the human and social problems seem to be much more complicated, have many more variables than do any of our technical problems. And just to illustrate what I mean, each of us comes into this world with a significantly individual personality the very day we're born. I mean, they're significantly different that first day. And from then on, each one begins to develop in his own separate individual direction. Is it any wonder that this large number of real individuals have difficulty working together and communicating with each other in a constructive manner? I think automation, in a broad sense, has the potential of enabling us to at least study the infinite numbers of variables in human behavior. But the monster machine must indeed remain the servant of man and not his master. Well, so much for that. Let's look at the record now on this automation thing we hear so much fear about. Just 2 years ago, George Meany described automation as a real curse to this society with no elements of blessing in it. He commented that automation was the dominant cause behind the persistent and serious problem of hardcore unemployment in our society. But yet, on the other side of the question, we are presently in the midst of the tightest labor market ever to confront this nation, including World War II. Also, our employment rate is lower than it has been since 1944, in spite of the fact that this increasing technology has absorbed almost 13 million more people since that time. Now, you might expect me to spend my time this morning denouncing some of the critics and provide you with a volatile debate for entertainment purposes, but first, I'm not a good debater, and I think too much time has already gone by. If, and let me repeat, if we are interested in achieving real progress in a free society, which I keep hearing most of us are concerned about. The end effect of automation properly understood is really nothing more than increase productivity through technology. It can, has, and will provide an opportunity to restructure many jobs so that the whole man may be challenged by a whole job. As for management, the use of the computer and the new systems approach to decision making is perhaps our most exciting possibility. To quote Fred Capel of AT&T, quote, "While the magazine writers are worrying about how computers will do our thinking for us, I will take a different point of view here and say that their greatest impact, at least in the foreseeable future, will be in forcing us to think. In fact, my guess is that of all the tools mankind has ever had, this is the one that most peremptorily requires us to use our heads. Now, of course, automation is a curse if we lock our vision to the past and try to solve the serious problems in manners which guarantee the preservation of outmoded institutions and techniques. Automation, on the other hand, is a blessing if we utilize the new technology effectively, while at the same time we examine what must be done in human terms to reap the benefits of our technical progress. Our primary task, then, is to unleash the creative forces in man rather than those of destruction and despair. I know that's a lot easier to talk about than it is to do. The so-called hurricane of automation that some people claim is going on would really have to show up in the record either as a rapid increase in net unemployment or rapid increase in the rate of productivity. But neither of these consequences in extreme is apparent in the last decade or so, during the time which automation has made its greatest advance. The record indicates the rate of unemployment now at something under 4%, significant below the 6.7% of only 1961. It's presently the lowest since 1944. In terms of productivity, the rate of growth of output per man hour is calculated, or if you calculate it on the 1909 basis of the U.S. Department of Labor, has accelerated only from an average of 2% per year during the period of 1909 to 1947 to now an average of about 3% a year over the span of 47 to 1966. We might well pause to reflect in 1905, 225,000 Americans were busy making wagons. And 10 years later, the automobile industry came in and displaced all of them. But by today, we now have over 2 million people building automobiles. And I haven't any idea how many more people are involved in the various industries composed of the suppliers of materials and parts to automobiles. Seems like there's a general observation here that new products always create new jobs. In General Electric, for instance, over 40% of their employees now work on products that were non-existent 12 years ago. And right here at home, Tektronix, which as most of you know was a brand new industry in 1946, today employs over 6,000 people, derives 50% of its revenues from products developed in the last 5 years and 13% in just our last fiscal year. And oddly enough, our largest single market today is the computer industry. Just try to estimate the number of people gainfully employed in the computer industry alone, in manufacturing, selling, and servicing. All new jobs, non-existent a decade or so ago. With rare exceptions, during the last 150 years in this country, labor and capital somehow have been able to keep the workforce of this country occupied about 95% of the time. This really is a remarkable record, one that is an envy of the world. Seems to me that it would be extremely immature at this time to conclude that the record cannot continue indefinitely, even with some improvement. There can be no greater disservice, indeed no greater act of contempt, than to substitute easy slogans or overgeneralizations for scrupulous honesty in analyzing these crucial issues. Well, now let's take a couple minutes to look at some of the creative aspects of automation. The easiest jobs, of course, to automate are those which are repetitive and monotonous. Such jobs do not allow for much development of the potential yet untapped in the majority of human beings. Many of the entry jobs that have allegedly been disappearing have typically been dead-end jobs anyway, going nowhere. And meanwhile, a great many new jobs have been created. This is especially so in the trade and service industries. Obviously, there has to be some displacement in the low-skilled jobs that are being eliminated by automation. But let us perceive this as an opportunity instead of a problem. Dr. Hertzberg, I think, made a good fundamental point that people get satisfaction out of doing something worthwhile. Well, here's a chance for more people to do things worthwhile. What about the chance to finally tackle and resolve such problems as those of functional illiteracy or of the obsolescing skills? What about it being a chance to do something for those traditionally ill-equipped to win? Might this be a chance to convert the workforce into a real dynamic force, such as society has never before seen? In my opinion, it is the very process of automation that has and will continue to free men from the monotonous tasks of the assembly line. A man's work must be perceived and understood as an integral part of life itself. You say, how do we do this? I believe we must concentrate upon education techniques and improvement or training. It is essential to the fast changes of an automated society. The closer one gets to the technology of the future, the more clearly one sees how it demands more, not less, from men. Companies will probably, therefore, as a fact of competitive life, take on an aura of institutions of higher learning. Rapid, accelerated development of human talent is the answer. That is to upgrade, maximize, and elevate the human capacity. In George Gallup's recent book, The Miracle Ahead, we find a related challenging thought. Quote, in the whole history of man, no generation has been taught to expect change, to be prepared for change, or to seek change. End of quote. Perhaps now is the time to start teaching a little bit about change. While automation does not result in a net destruction of jobs, it certainly does pose problems of adjustment and relocation of labor effort. A much more creative, deliberate, and intensive program will be needed in the future, I'll admit, than has prevailed in the past, to train and retrain our labor force for the interesting assignments that lie ahead. But I would like to remind you that haste may cause us to administer medicine for a non-existent disease, lest we really make the patient, in this case, the national economy, sick. If we do achieve security from automation, but in the process lose real freedom, we would hardly represent a worthwhile achievement. As Alfred North Whitehead said, the art of progress is to preserve order amid change, and to preserve change amid order. Now for a little more careful delineation of the subject, not in ominous, foreboding terms that defy reasoned evaluation, but rather in a way that allows those who are truly interested in addressing themselves to the solution of problems to cut out a slice and begin to define real measures for solving real problems. Since it is really human problems that we're concerned with, that is, our investment in human capital, let us begin by defining the problem in terms of the unemployed people or the underemployed at a time while we're in the midst of this very dynamic economy and even in the midst of this very extremely tight labor market. If we are moving essentially from a blue-collar to a white-collar economy, one which offers fewer opportunities for the unskilled and undereducated, and we certainly are moving in that direction, let us not throw up our hands in despair. Let's not cut off our nose to spite our face. For example, artificially attempt to slow down the process of change. To the contrary, let us accept the challenge. Let us try to elevate the whole population so as to truly solve the problems of the undereducated and the unskilled. This is a real opportunity, and there is real evidence that we are not myth-making, but instead are squarely confronting reality. And if we succeed, there is other evidence to indicate that we will all have much greater satisfaction with our individual lives, as has been referred to earlier, in the nature of one's mental health from achievement. Then we need to define the problem. And to begin, this is admittedly somewhat oversimplified, but it really is truly impossible to solve poverty as such, or the problems of the disadvantaged. We first must ask ourselves in terms of people. In a society that is technologically advancing rapidly, what individuals lack what basic prerequisites if they are to be productive contributors in our society today? Where are they? What resources are presently available and already proven that could be marshaled to some of these problem solutions? What gaps are there that must be fulfilled? And finally, and only after answering the above, how do we proceed? Well, let's start with the people problems. The 1960 census shows that 60% of our adult population, that is about 58 million people out of 99 million adults, haven't even completed high school. So if you look into this area of competence, there seem to be four basic areas of definable people problems that lend themselves to immediate solution. The first category are those individuals who possess not only no marketable skill, but they have no basic skills in either reading or arithmetic. The second category would be those individuals who are literate, all right, but have no particular marketable skills. A third category would be people who possess both of the above, but due to advancing technology, find their skills obsolescing. And the fourth group could be differentiated only because solutions are available unique to their problem, and that is a burgeoning part of our population known as the high school dropouts. Well, where do we find these people? 80% of the 15 million functional illiterates are presently employed, mostly by industry, in the private sector of our economy. And I believe the functional illiterate term here is used to refer to people with lower than fifth grade reading and arithmetic skills. In the second category, most of these people who are literate but have no particular skills are presently employed in today's labor market. The third category, those that are obsolescing, that have obsolescing skills due to technology progress, are still mostly all employed in industry. But the fourth area is really the trouble spot. We have still around 1 million dropouts per year from the public schools. Their real performance level at the time of dropout is usually only about half of the grade they're in, even so. This group has the highest incidence of unemployment of any of the four groups I've just mentioned. Contains more than 40%, 45% of this country's total unemployed. So you might say, well, what are some possible solutions to this kind of a problem? Well, first of all, with the functional illiterates, I guess we have to give them some basic education. And I've heard a lot of people say that these people are not educable, but there have been many demonstration projects underway recently that prove the contrary. It is possible today to elevate a person four grade levels in reading and arithmetic in an average time of 160 hours with a cost of only $150. This means that an individual who is now in the third or fourth grade level can be rapidly brought to a point well above the national average of ninth grade in less than 350 hours at a cost of around $300. This is not fiction, but a proven fact. It's actually going on right now. I know of eight major American corporations that are doing this, and I'm sure there are many more that I don't know about, but some of them are companies like Diamond Alkali Company of Houston, Texas, the Chemical Bank, New York Trust Company in New York City, College Life Insurance Company of Indianapolis, Corn Products Company of New York. We might also mention that considerable pilot work has been done in basic education and also typing in the New York office of the NAM. I happen to be on their board of directors at present time, and so I hear a little of this. But they have decided that industry can solve a lot of its own problems if they would just have the confidence to tackle them. And so they're trying some experimental research-type projects right back there in New York City. One recent class of six dropout teenagers who tested in grade levels between 3.9 and 9.3 at the start after 6 weeks, had progressed an average of 3 grade levels. That's pretty fast. However, they've been taking a slightly different approach than most of the more conventional educators. They assume, first of all, that if these people dropped out of school, there's something about the environment maybe that isn't conducive to their learning. So they have changed the environment entirely in this experiment. They, instead of having these people come to a formal classroom with a professional teacher and 40 or 50 of them sit down in chairs, while they take them in small groups around a table with somebody who is a non-professional but has the basic belief that these people really want to do something if they just knew how. And the results are proving fantastic. Another thing they've tried recently back there is a program on teaching typing skill to, I believe the initial experiment was with all Negro and Puerto Rican dropouts. And using a program learning technique and audio teaching equipment, a secretary can be trained to conduct this course in 1 day. The results of this course have brought these girls in from 6 to 7 weeks up to a typing speed of 40 to 55 words per minute at a total cost of $8 per week per student, including books. While it is difficult to obtain accurate statistics on functional illiterates, there's pretty strong evidence that for maybe around $2 billion, this entire problem could be solved in this country. You might say that's a staggering cost, but really not, when one considers that industry alone already spends about 6 times that amount annually for education and implant training. Well, now to get into the second and third areas here. I just talked about functional illiterates. The second and third area, remember, are the people who are literate but who have no marketable skills, or the skills that they do have are being outmoded. Technology is presently available, applying innovative concepts in this area to enable us to rapidly accelerate efforts in learning. And an example of that would be the DuPont Company that's developed over 140 courses for specific craft skills. At this point in time, over 40,000 of their people have been trained utilizing these techniques. They're self-administered. The retention of knowledge increases an average of 35% over other methods. There's 25% reduction in time and 30% reduction in cost. With regard to other examples of local leadership and independent high school action, one of many examples of the local solution is the Bedford, Ohio Industrial Education Program. There are many such programs of this nature actually in operation around the country. So far in the Bedford program, they have had 100% placement from the participants in this course, which involves both the educational system of the community and industry. Many other communities have initiated similar programs. Among these is the Opportunities Industrialization Center Incorporated in Philadelphia. This was opened in a previously abandoned police station recently, in 1964. They've already trained 1,800 graduates in industry and business with a placement rate of 85%. Well, now, to get on to the fourth and most difficult category here, the high school dropouts. As I said, this problem is not insoluble. There have been dramatic instances where communities have cut their rate in half or even better through constructive programs. Examples of this type of action are the Prudential Insurance Company of Newark, New Jersey, where people come into their plant, their office, using their equipment after hours for learning. Company instructors and materials are provided. J.I. Case Company of Racine, Wisconsin is another one. The Carson, Perry, Scott and Company of Chicago, Illinois is a leading retailer, was concerned with the dropout problem. So they participated with local education system. And since then, there are now 25 companies in the Chicago area have set up similar programs. We've already seen a proliferation of these programs across the country and a number of communities working well. And they work well because the basic motivation is high. Specific skills are taught that are usable in the future. And a clear relationship between education and future work is perceived. And I can even remember some difficulty I had back in the early days, wondering why I was wasting time learning about a lot of things. But if we can get the education system geared to the things that we as students can understand, students, I'm sure, can go a lot further faster. Cutting across all of these specific areas is the problem of more effectively matching people to jobs, particularly at the low and medium skill levels. The NAM in the last is now in a 6 weeks into a project in cooperation with General Electric's Valley Forge Computer Center, wherein they are hopefully going to design a computer-based instrument capable not only of matching, but more important, capable of precisely defining the real gaps that do exist between the requirements to fill available jobs in a community and the skills presently available in the unemployed population of our society. Well, I guess we're down to about the end of this. You say, what are the possibilities now for action? While there are admittedly many problems caused by the changes taking place, perhaps they are soluble by less than a total change in our society. It also may provide us remarkable opportunities for progress. Second, it seems evident that we cannot afford to talk in generalities, gravely predicting a gloomy outcome. We must attempt, at least, to forthrightly define the problem as they exist in reality today. And third, if you accept the foregoing, we then should use scientific methods to search out proven solutions and ways to ensure their utilization throughout all the hamlets and communities of the land. At this point, you might ask, what are the so-called facts to indicate that the individual citizen, the community, and the state have the potential to actually solve such problems in this very complex society? And further, with the federal government so active in all of its manifold activities, what can we do? Well, here are a few ideas. An almost unknown American citizen until maybe last year published a fascinating book called Reclaiming the American Dream. The author, Richard C. Cornell, some of you might have heard speak in Portland just a week or so ago. His book points out that we have almost forgotten there is a thing which he calls the independent sector in our society. By this, he is referring to the independent association of American citizens, such as churches, labor unions, trade organizations, service clubs, private welfare groups, foundations, schools, and so forth. He reminds us that the famous French student of 1805 to 1859, Alexis de Tocqueville, saw three sectors in America. A then very primitive commercial sector, a carefully limited government sector, and most important of all, a very unique and vigorous independent sector, which set this nation apart from all others. In one of his works, de Tocqueville said, "Americans make associations," which is his word for the independent institutions. "Americans make associations to give entertainments, found seminaries, to build inns, to construct churches, to diffuse books, to found hospitals, prisons, and schools." At that time, he felt these associations were a significant key to the development of our nation. Mr. Cornell points out, however, since the Depression of the 30s, most writers have tended to write off the very sector that de Tocqueville thought most important. He feels the reason for this is the upsurge of big government has simply overawed even the independent sector itself, and certainly has tended to make most people look only in one direction for the solution of all social problems. But here are some interesting statistics. Mr. Cornell pointed out some of these assets that we have long lost sight of. In this country, we have 320,000 churches with 118 million members, with assets of $15 billion. We have 100,000 or more voluntary welfare groups, like we are all familiar with in every community of this country. We have 6,000 private foundations worth about another $15 billion. Hundreds of fraternal and service organizations with over 36 million members. We have hundreds of labor unions with a total of about 13 million members. We have 3,500 independent hospitals and thousands more of independent nursing homes. We have over 1,300 private colleges and universities that enroll 1.75 million students, and 17,000 private schools, more than 2,000 community CHESS, United Funds. In addition to which, in the private sector of our economy, we have 4.75 million business institutions, which incidentally take on many public responsibilities that have apparently nothing to do with making a profit. Well, with those kind of assets among us, what about the size of the job to be done? Mr. Cornell says that industry itself spends billions on employee education. General Electric Company, for instance, spends more money on education than any other private or public institution in the state of New York. I have been told that IBM spends more money on education than Harvard University. Mr. Cornell estimates that business executives right now give time that totals up to about $5 billion a year to charitable causes. Maybe some of you have read George Gallup's recent book, which I referred to earlier, The Miracle Ahead, but he claims that in his polls and projections therefrom, that 61 million citizens of this country would like to help improve their communities if they just knew how. Further, that they have in total agreed to donate 245 million hours per week. That's a pretty big figure. That happens to be equal to the total hours worked by all of the employees. This is equal to the monthly total employed in five of our largest industries: automobiles, food processing, clothing, railroads, and department stores. Well, it seems to me that with the problems of society that we can see and label, see solutions to, with the fantastic extension possible now of the human brain by cybernetics procedure, that we certainly ought to be able to solve these problems. One of the unique differences between the independent sector of our country and the other sectors up to now has been that innovations in this sector don't seem to get transmitted easily from one to the other. Would seem to me that people like those of us right here in this room that would take the trouble to come down and try to learn about how we do anything better are just typical of the kind of people that could cause a lot of these things to happen. If we make a decision to do this, I think it simply means we've got to further define the problems more precisely. We've got to find more and better solutions, and there are many solutions already existing all over the country, if we can just make this information known to the rest of us. And fourth, if we can develop action systems here to do the job. While we may be able to do a little more than discuss this in the remainder of today's meetings, perhaps at least these comments will provoke some serious future thought and discussion amongst you. And looking ahead, I would hope that we would give recognition to industries past, as well as the power of our independent sector, and demand that a major role for the private and independent sectors be maintained in the solution of these major problems. With this, we should be able to capture the blessings of automation and raise an even better qualified free citizenry to take our place in the years to come. And with that, I'd like to simply close with a quotation of Woodrow Wilson's quote: "The great struggling unknown masses are the dynamic force that is lifting the levels of society. A nation is as great, and only as great, as her rank and file." Thank you.
Thank Thank you, Jack Murdoch, for those very thoughtful and studied comments. We'll look forward to seeing and hearing more from you tonight. I have just three short announcements, if I may take a moment of your time. One, Guy Leonard has asked that you be reminded that the program today and the last 2 days and the one tomorrow morning are being taped. Those tapes are available through Guy and his staff at the Portland Chamber of Commerce, and we hope those of you who see a way to use them will take advantage.